The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives.
Hey, Alexa.
What?
It's our 25th published episode. Go us!
Congrats, pal. We made it. Well, to 25 at least.
And hopefully 25 more at least. Well, it's been certainly a fun year of recording episodes with a lot of interesting guests. And I don't know, do you think a year ago we would have imagined that we would make it this far?
I don't know. I think we just decided to do it and, you know, come what may. And we did it just on topics that interested us with guests that we wanted to talk to. And it's been a fun journey since then.
Cool stuff. Well, let's get to our episode now.
I am Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In the last few years, words like fake news, alternative facts, conspiracy theories, deep fakes, misinformation, and disinformation have entered into heavy rotation in our daily discourse. Misinformation is simply wrong or misleading information. Disinformation is to knowingly disseminate misinformation with the intent to deceive. The key difference here is one of intent. To be more specific, disinformation involves a nefarious motive and a sense of organization and purpose, hence the term disinformation campaign. Disinformation campaigns have been around since ancient times, so the concept is nothing new. What is new is the addition of the internet. The internet has supercharged the creation, distribution, and amplification of such campaigns. Online trolling, harassment, and distraction, especially by highly active automated accounts, are just a few of the key components of the modern disinformation purveyor's toolkit. If a malevolent falsehood is like a virus that is deliberately spread to vulnerable hosts, and if a bit of code or malware is also like a virus that is deliberately spread to vulnerable hosts, then are there lessons learned from combating cyber criminals that can be leveraged in battling disinformation campaigns? Is there a source which catalogs cyber criminal techniques? As it turns out, there is. In 2013, MITRE Corporation, a not-for-profit that supports several US government agencies, began developing the adversarial tactics, techniques, and common knowledge, or ATT&CK framework. Officially released in 2015 and updated several times since then, the framework is a globally accessible knowledge base of adversary tactics and techniques based on real-world observations of cybersecurity threats. Think of it like a living inventory of all forms of malfeasance in circulation amongst hackers. Can we record and reference a similar inventory for disinformation campaigns? Can minutia, like use of a persistent misspelling of a word in viral posts or use of a particular font, help reveal the origin, scope, and purpose of a campaign?
Our guest is Sarah Jane Terp. Sarah Jane, or SJ, is a data strategist with decades of experience in autonomous systems and their effects on humanity. She's taught data science at Columbia University, was CTO of the UN's big data team, designed machine learning algorithms and unmanned vehicle systems at the UK Ministry of Defense. She holds degrees in AI and neural networks and used them to build situational awareness for intelligence, transport, disaster, and crowdsourced advocacy systems. She chairs the Cognitive Security Co-Lab and works on disinformation defenses. Welcome, SJ.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there's an interesting story on how you came about to think of this problem, starting with an invitation by the U.S. Special Operations Command in Tampa, Florida, on the anniversary of D-Day to think about something hypothetical. If the Normandy invasion were to happen today, what would it look like? But ultimately, what came out of that day wasn't about D-Day. It was about how to handle disinformation campaigns. Can you tell us that story?
Well, actually, by that point, I'd been working on disinformation for the best part of a decade and a lot longer before encountering. So the SOCOM, so the Special Operations Command, has an innovations unit, an open innovations unit called SoftWorks. And I'm one of the people they call in when they have an interesting problem, especially an interesting problem that touches on technology. So hackers in the sense of people who look at the world, work out what's happening in it, put it back together differently. So I'm one of the hackers they call in. So they called in the usual suspects for this idea that if there was another D-Day, what would you do differently with deception? And my grandfathers were both part of the original deceptions for the real D-Day. So this is a wonderful piece of family history as well. So we looked at it and we started brainstorming, and we realized pretty quickly that we were going to separate into two rooms. And I would have loved to stay with the physical deceptions people, because that's also an area of interest, but I took command of how would we do online deception? How would we do online deception if there was another D-Day coming? How would we counter it? And we had some really interesting people in the room, because you've mixed the, as Sophox does, you mixed the hackers, you mixed deep technologists, you mixed military and government in the same place, thinking together, working together. And out of that came this idea that I'd started developing before, but it solidified that what we were really looking at wasn't just misinformation as a news problem, as a media problem, but what we were facing was a large-scale hack attack, a very large-scale series of incidents where, instead of computers connected together with wires being the objects that were being attacked, what was actually being used were people's brains and the communities that connected those brains together. So if you look at it that way, you suddenly start to see things like vulnerabilities. So as an InfoSec person, you're looking at the whole system, you're looking at where in the system is vulnerable. You're looking at different ways that you can hijack that system, enter that system, adapt that system to your own needs, to your own ends. And when you start looking at it that way, you start seeing ways to counter it. So you've mentioned attack. One of the people in the room was one of the original people working on attack. And that was Pablo Brewer. And we came out of that room having written a report that we can't read. And we started building a collection of other people who were also on this boundary between disinformation, misinformation, and information security. So we built this collection of what we called misinfosec, misinformation plus security people, put them all in one space, got them all talking to each other, realized we needed common language. So at the time, you've already said campaign, but we had marketing people, because if you look properly at misinformation, you can see it as marketing that's just gone bad. So you can do things like sales funnels for radicalization. Again, same counters work. So we had marketing people, we had military people, we had technologists, and each of those, if you said campaign, had a different definition for it. So we built alongside that misinfosec group. I was already part of the Credibility Coalition, which is a standards body for misinformation. And oh, as an aside, you've mentioned the differences between misinformation and disinformation being intent. There's more difference than that. Misinformation is fake content. Disinformation, the really good disinformation, uses real content. I think the golden ratio is about 10% fake to about 90% true. And disinformation campaigns have, as the 2016 Black American campaigns, will use genuine grievances, genuine materials, but the falsehood is elsewhere in the system. So it may be that you're using fake accounts, either trolls or botnets. It may be you're creating fake groups. There have been a lot of those. Fake activities all the way through. So we use a slightly different definition. It's not just fake content, and the response isn't just to concentrate on content. You have to concentrate on the whole system. Again, this is something that, as information security people, we've been doing for a very long time. It's not just going looking for specific pieces of malware. Can you remember the catalogs? We used to have catalogs of malware. You would upload the catalog and that would be your thing, your defense for a while. And that's shifted. So I'm also part of the machine learning and information security community. And the shift there has been to looking at behavior rather than just content. So this also, it's a very long-winded explanation, I'm sorry, but it's explaining why we did this thing. And there are a set of models. It's not just a single model, but the one that we concentrated on was the behavior models, the attack style, tactics, techniques, procedures models. So what are the activities that we're seeing in each incident? Again, language. What we look at is short-term, days, weeks, not much longer, incidents that are quite often part of a much longer running campaign. So 2016 election would be seen as a campaign. Anti-vax would be seen as a campaign. You would get smaller incidents within that.
So maybe a couple of questions, just sort of to a bit of context there. So just in terms of your work, if you look at what's been going on in the US, primarily in the US, but really globally, but let's say in the US for the last 5 years, 6 years, would you say that there's been an uptick of disinformation campaigns? First question. Or is it just sort of a natural progression? Or is it just normal behavior, normal background radiation?
I think uptick is an understatement. It's been open season.
Right.
I mean, you had disinformation, or rather propaganda capabilities in a lot of countries, realizing that you could do that at scale and that you could have real world effects on another country.
Right.
There are now dozens of countries who are subject to it, large numbers who are actually using it, either on each other or on their own populations. Looking at you, Venezuela. But so in the US, we've seen it starting really with the Internet Research Agency from Russia, who was, as many of these, starting with those marketing principles. So online marketing, you've got an audience, you've got a message, you can measure how well you're doing. That it's very amenable. We saw the anti-vaxxers. So you see people doing this for geopolitics, you see people doing this for money. We saw what were called the Macedonian teens, who were putting up websites that were political in nature, aimed at the US, sometimes were using the memes being put through by places like the IRA. And they were doing it for money, for eyeballs, for views and clicks.
Right.
Being paid for online advertising.
To the general person who's, you know, just looking at information going by, I mean, I would have said my personal perspective was that in the course of the last 5 years, there was a lot more disinformation flying around with wild abandon, but that's just a personal perspective. So I'm, you know, it's heartening to hear that it's also expertly supported. But it can, to the general person, it can just sort of seem like, oh, wow, there's a lot of crap going around. And some of it really is amplified by people who are completely unwittingly sucked into this, right? I mean, I have high school friends who are not part of any conspiracy, but, you know, have been sucked into the anti-vaxxer perspective and will cheerfully tell you how they're not going to, you know, they're not going to get vaccinated because vaccinations are terrible. And anyway, I don't want to go off on that tangent. What I wanted to come back to was for the general person, it just seems like there's just an awful lot of noise out there. What do you see when you look at this? Do you see more coherence? Can you tease apart and detect those different campaigns that you described and, you know, break it down into maybe not identifying the actual perpetrators, but at least a more coherent picture of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we separate out what we do tactically, which is in the moment, try to find what is going on, try to find ways to counter that, from the strategic work of doing things like working out who is actually doing this. Attribution is really hard. On top of everything else, you have governments faking, pretend to be each other. It's difficult work. We're more interested in see this stuff and try to stop it. Right. And it's... Sorry, what was the question?
So it just, for you, it is not, you know, millions of voices all chattering different things. You're seeing more patterning here, yes?
Yeah. Oh, okay, sorry, yes. I'm a data scientist. So this is large amounts of data. We did this for crisis mapping for disaster data 10 years ago. So again, reusing techniques we had before. A lot of what we've done in the past couple of years has been trying to produce things that are useful very, very, very quickly, because we knew that the United States didn't have time to wait for a 5-year DARPA plan. It had to have resources and fast. So as a data scientist, I can do things like large-scale text analysis, so looking for repeated text. You can do narrative analysis, so you'll start looking for themes running through over time across places. And most useful to us has been doing network analysis. So not just the things, but the connections between them. So you can look at pretty much everything as a network. For example, networks in here, you have networks between users, but you also have networks between narratives or user phrases. You have networks of images being used. And there's this combination of using machine learning techniques and tools to look for those patterns, but also using specialist human teams, so open source intelligence teams, who are able to track back through across lots of different platforms and to look for where things have come from, where they're spreading. So questions like, who were the super spreaders?
Right.
Really simple stuff, like, you know, the anti-Farum buses rumor, we were tracking back through local Facebook groups. And we were tracking back to the URLs that were involved. So which domains are pushing these narratives? And there's been, back to your question of, has there been a lot more? You have countries setting up disinformation domains. So it's been pretty relentless for the past few years.
You mentioned, you know, it's an uptick is an understatement. There's a book by Peter Pomerantsev. Mm-hmm. It's This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. And in it, he describes not just the US, but the impact that disinformation campaigns have had even in the elections in the Philippines, where they, you know, there's a whole industry of what they call advertising agencies, but in fact, mm-hmm. there's sort of one step above troll farms, where they take a message that these automatic bots are just spreading out, and then sometimes they decide humans, that they decide, oh, maybe mm-hmm. we need to now add an additional twist. So it's really, the work that you're doing is incredibly fascinating. And at the time that we're living today, which is, you know, we're talking on January 15th, barely a week after January 6th, where
2021.
Right, 2021, where the impact of the disinformation campaign wasn't just necessarily to change people's way of voting, it really was to get people out into the streets and to now get them to be radicalized in such a way to take action, sometimes, you know, quite violent action. So that's sort of a long way of asking you, is there a pattern that you're seeing in the data that you're following and the techniques where it's the disinformation campaigns have gone above just trying to muddle the field or cause confusion or sow discord or get somebody to vote one way or another, but to really radicalize people to take, you know, take up arms, take action?
I mentioned sales funnels. These are extremist sales funnels. Disinformation is a tool in that, very much so. And it's not just over in the US. You can look back to places like the Ukraine for earlier examples of this being used. You've talked about the Philippines. The Philippines factories is disinformation as a service, but they've used on their own populations. Looking across, so part of my earlier work was with United Nations and working on elections around the world. And there's always been misinformation in elections. There's always been misinformation in populations. This is about it being done at scale and targeted. So it's not just, you know, don't vote for the other guy. It's not just, hey, maybe we should get upset about this. This yeah. is pushing those emotions and really, really keeping those emotions rolling and radicalizing people you wouldn't normally expect.
Just to kind of hone in on what you said, a sales funnel, which is really an interesting kind of parallel, because with the marketing, you're trying to get people to be aware of something, to create a preference for it, ultimately to make a choice, to buy something. In this sales funnel, you're talking about getting people to be aware of an idea, maybe have a preference for it. But to radicalize somebody, you really have to separate out your audience, right? You really have to identify those who are most vulnerable. How do they do that?
Well, same as sales. You're looking for people who are likely to adopt. And the other part of that sales funnel, by the way, is the point at which people are advocating for the brand. Mm. So it's getting people to radicalize the people around them. And there are all sorts of really good tools. The Facebook advertising tools are really great for finding you a specific population. You can do A-B testing, put out messages, try different variants of those messages, see what people go for. The Macedonian teens, a couple of them are on record of saying that they tried putting up sites for liberals and conservatives, and the conservatives were just more consistent coming in and reading them. The market was better. It's literally market. So it's micro-targeting. And part of what we looked at with the AMIT models was, what's the difference between pump priming, where you're putting information out to a few influencers so that they then influence their followers, pushing out a flood of information to the general public, and very, very, very specific one-to-one communications, things like SMS messages, things like targeted adverts. So those are the things that you can use, but the way to find the people is to use existing advertising segmentation or variants on the methods you use for advertising segmentation. It's a lot of data out there.
You've mentioned AMIT models, which I think are related to the MITRE ATT&CK framework that you mentioned. Can you tell us a bit about what AMIT models are?
Okay, so one of the things we did back in 2018 was we needed a way to describe the behaviors, and we needed a consistent way that we could rapidly share messages about what was happening in an incident. So we looked at all sorts of models. We looked at psychological operations models from the military. We looked at those sales funnels, and we looked at existing information security models, including ATT&CK. And we realized that ATT&CK had a whole set of tools around it, and that most of the information security units that we wanted to add disinformation to were already using it. So it was an existing tool. We tried to make disinformation fit into the set of stages. So the idea of stages is you group the techniques into a stage of operation. So for us, we have planning stages. We have a set of preparation stages that include developing out the people online, developing out the networks across them, those micro-targetings, developing content, selecting channels. We have execution stages, evaluation. The idea is that if you list these out sequentially, the further left in your diagram you go, the more effect you will have on mitigating a campaign or mitigating an incident. But we basically took a bunch of experts, a very large pile of post-its, a set of existing incidents, and we took those incidents to pieces, found all the techniques we could in those incidents, wrote each of those on a post-it, and just pointed the experts at a wall, grouped them, and then separated those out into stages. So we worked which ones are grouped together, which ones happened before each other, if we looked at this as a linear thing. It's not entirely linear. You know, you get the same operations happening. You might be pump priming, pushing some information out to influencers whilst you're still developing your content, for example. But that was the idea. The other thing that was important is this idea of left and right of boom. So the attack model is aimed at somebody whose system has just been breached. So what are the things that are happening inside your system once somebody has broken into it? There's a pre-attack model for the things they're doing before that point. You want to get as far as left as you can. We've done the same with disinformation. The planning and preparation stages, they're equivalent to the pre-attack. In explosives terms, I said removing explosives, it's the left of boom, right of boom. So it's before the bang happens. You want, if you can, to disrupt an incident before it gets to the public.
That sort of leads to where I wanted to go next, which is, it sounds like that you've made progress in terms of, you know, characterizing and identifying and distinguishing between individual campaigns, because I imagine there are many, or at least more than one campaign aiming this at the same targets at the same time. What are the steps towards actually mitigating? And, you know, you said it's been relentless. What are the steps to get out of this relentless mode and actually start cleaning things up?
So some of those started with that D-Day meeting. We started on counters back then. But we also had a second bunch of experts with a lot of post-its. And one of the things you can build if you have a model like attack is something called a course of action matrix. So you list all of the stages you have. You list different ways of responding. So we have the Ds. So this is detect, because at the time we built this, everybody was focused on just looking at disinformation campaigns, not responding. They were basically take down the botnets, educate people, that was it. Deny, you want to stop them getting into your system. You want to stop this getting to people at all. But once they've got in, you've got options still. You can interrupt them, so you can disrupt what they're doing. You can slow them down, a degrade move. You can do things like slow down the speed that their message is propagating. The deceive is cool. So we're seeing honeypots. So you can build systems so they spend their resources, their attention being one of the resources, time being another, on something that isn't the community they're trying to target. And that we think has legs. Destroy, stop it happening in the first place. Favorite one of those is that somebody called Imperfect Russian a bomb alert into the IRA. So you stop them working by they're not physically in a building. And deter. So discourage the people who are creating these campaigns. So that might be at a nation state level with sanctions that might be at a personal level. One of the things we came up with back with the D-Day was, hey, why don't we pay the people who are doing disinformation? Just find the teams, offer them better jobs. So there's all sorts of tactics you can use. And we came up with 186 of these things. And we got, we're planning to clean them up, put them out back in January. And COVID happened. We ended up running responses. So one of the other things we brought over from information security is this idea of security operation centers. So how do you build a team that's monitoring and responding and keeps monitoring and responding? So SOCs are teams dedicated to responding to information security events, but they do other things. They do all of the infrastructure setup work, including training, to be able to do the monitoring, but they also do risk reduction. So we'd been doing things like running red teams, where if we had a live campaign, we got a bunch of people together in the room, played being the other guys, the campaign creators, and thought about what their next moves might be, thought in terms of the restrictions they had. So there were these different activities moving around that. But we were talking about counters. So at last, a year late, we produced an attack style diagram for the countermeasures. So there are now two AMIT diagrams. There's one with little gray squares for all of the incident techniques and tactics and procedures. And there's one with little cream squares for all of the countermeasures and mitigations, all listed by stage. And we have a repository, so you can pick any one of these and see all the other ones connected to it. And the next step from that is to allow people to take these tiles and build descriptions of campaigns, but also plot ahead. So if you've seen one technique, you've seen counters used on it, you see that technique again, would the same counters work, for example?
In a way, it sounds like, I love those. So you sort of answered my question about how this is almost like setting up a SOC, but not for cybersecurity incidents. It's really the same sort of disciplines that you have in a SOC. So is part of this to also create a sort of parallel like you have for a SOC and really get some of these methods to be automated in some tools,
yes,
right? Automated detection, automated response, right? That's the idea?
Very much so. You can't do it all, just like content moderation, you can't do it all with automation, yeah, but you can help the analysts with good right, automation. So there are different sizings. We ran the CTI League disinformation team last year as a SOC. So that's a full size embedded inside a disinformation, inside information security SOC team on its own right, with its own processes, team structures, procedures. But you can also put a disinformation desk into an existing information security SOC.
Right.
And the other thing that we worked up at the other end of the scale was the cognitive security ISAL. So having a clearinghouse for disinformation data across a whole group of organizations, not just a single one.
So we're now in it. In other words, you know, you said there was a massive uptick was an understatement. So we're now in it. We have various things like the anti-vaxxers, the QAnon folks, the folks that believe that elections were stolen, you know, all sorts of conspiracy theories. And now there's some folks whose beliefs are so steadfast that as a result of this sort of continuing information, disinformation campaign, do you think that some of the very same ways they got to be this way, in other words, the same disinformation campaign tactics that were used against them to believe these things, can be used to get them to disavow or let go of these beliefs? Or does it just work one way?
It isn't just one way. Again, there are segmentations on there are some people who are hardcore, some people who are a long way down the rabbit hole, other people who can be persuaded out, other people who are just going to walk away when they're not on the feeds anymore. So we have two separate things that we're connected with. One is part of the team are working on how do you do mass cult deprogramming methods. So there's some really interesting work out there. Steve Hassan is one of them on what do you need to do to bring people back. The other one is there is a counter-narratives team called the Reality Team. And they have been pushing adverts and counter-narratives into the spaces disinformation is in. And they're finding they're starting to push the disinformation out. So if you, backing up slightly, one of the things that is a variable in here is trust. So I originally called this belief hacking, because what you're dealing with isn't truths and falsities, you're dealing with people's beliefs, and albeit very strongly held beliefs. And the important thing is to build sources of knowledge that can be trusted. It's to look for those spaces where disinformation is rife, but also to look for the information voids. Because places like local news, where local news papers have gone, there are spaces where they've been that disinformation providers have moved into. Correct. So look for where the space is and push into there, put the narratives into there.
This is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it has like elements of psychology. You know, there's not just the technology, but there's elements of psychology and sometimes cult psychology, because a lot of this to me sounds like how you would indoctrinate somebody in a cult, and it's just as hard to get them out of it.
Yeah, it very clearly a case where it's an unintended consequence of the right. technology of, you know, global communications and whatnot. So it's been a really fascinating exploration of the topic. And I'm sure we could keep going for hours yet. I'm sure that there's, you know, much more that we could explore. But I think we're going to have to save that for another day. And at this point, just say thank you very much, SJ, for a really interesting session.
Thank you.
It was phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.